They say having a passion for something can be either a gift or a curse. In the case of my next guest, it's most definitely the former. It's a gift. Greg French has devoted most of his life to the natural world. He's been a park ranger, a wilderness guide, and a hatchery officer for Tasmanian Fisheries. Greg's also a well-respected fly fisher. And when I say well-respected, like globally recognised, and he's written about it extensively, as well as about living a life in nature itself. His latest book, which I've been reading, is a collection of stories drawn from life in Tasmania and beyond. It's called Watercolour. Greg, welcome to Life Matters.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Michael.
Tell us about the place you live.
We live about 30 minutes northwest of Hobart, near New Norfolk, but in a neighbouring valley.
What's it called? That valley?
It's called Glendhu Rivulet, or the river is. And Glendhu is Scottish for Black Valley.
So Black Valley Rivulet.
Yep.
Why not creek or river? Why rivulet?
It's funny, like Tasmania has rivulets. I don't think there are rivulets anywhere else in Australia.
Yeah. But because I think of rivulets of sweat.
No, I think of them more like a rill or a burn, you know.
Nice.
But that's because I live in Tasmania and I grew up with rivulets everywhere.
So that's what it is.
Yeah.
And did you always live in that valley?
No, I was brought up on the east coast of Tasmania. In fact, my father's family owned French's farm on Maria Island. So for all those people who've walked on Maria Island,
which
French's farm is actually my family farm.
Golly, so you've got a real connection to Tasmania, its coast, and its inland.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the, do you still remember the first time you put a fly rod over a piece of water?
I certainly do. Now, because I grew up in Orford, actually, so just on the mainland opposite Maria Island, and my father was a cray fisherman, we spent a lot of time in the Mercury Passage, and we would go out flathead fishing, and we would put three hooks on a hand line, and before the line hit the bottom, it'd have three flathead on it, and that's great when you're 4 years old. By the time you're 6 or 7 years old, you're pretty well over it.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, it's just too easy.
And is that the problem?
So the great thing about fly fishing is that you...
I'm being a bit mocking because for me, that would be the constant satisfaction I would go on for the rest of my life, just catching flathead, because it's easy.
Right. Well, I think that when you're doing it day in, day out, from when you're really, really little, it actually does get a little bit boring. And the great thing about fly fishing is that... Well, we can take people out, I do a bit of guiding, and we can take rank beginners out, give them a fly rod, doesn't matter if they've never cast before. And yep. Even in Tasmania, which is one of the hardest places to catch brown trout in the world.
Why?
I'll get to that in a second.
Okay, sorry.
But we can generally get them to catch fish on their first day. And so it can be that easy, but to go from catching one or two fish a day to being able to catch good numbers of fish in really hard conditions, that's a lifetime of experience. So no matter how good you get at it, there's always more to learn. So the opportunity to keep improving, it's like every sportsman. You know, you want to actually be better than you were the day before. And you look at your peers, and if they're doing things that you aren't doing, you want to be able to do as well as they're doing as well. So it's a driving thing that keeps you going.
I want to talk about the underlying philosophy behind that as well, and that informs your book, Watercolour. But, Greg, what are the mechanics of fly fishing for someone like me who's never done it but is kind of attracted to the romanticism of it all?
Okay, fly fishing is different to casting a lure because the flies generally don't weigh very much and you can't just cast them out onto the water. Their own weight won't carry them out. So you actually use the line to carry the fly out on the water. And the casting is just beautiful. And some people who fly cast do it solely for the casting because it is just poetic and rhythmical. For me personally, I'm interested in the animals. And what the thing about the way we fish is you walk along a lake or a river, you look for the fish that you're going to cast to, so it's hunting. And then once you've seen the fish, then you present a fly in front of it.
So it's not just taking pot luck and hoping there's something in that stretch of river. You've really got to target that
trout.
Yeah,
definitely not. I mean, there are other ways of fly fishing. You can do exactly as you're saying, but because we fish in Tasmania where the water's clear and the trout are wild and there's heaps of opportunity, this is the method we all end up preferring. And, of course, there's a skill in being able to approach a lake, like I say, a giant lake, like Great Lake, and actually knowing where the fish are going to be. And
can that change from day to day?
Oh, definitely, very definitely. So, and from season to season. So to give you an idea of, say, how Great Lake works, when Great Lake's low, the weed bed's close to the water surface, and close to the shore, so you can fish from the shore really easily. When the lake is very high, those weed beds are offshore and deep down, so then you're relying on fish not actually in the weed beds, but the ones that bother to come to the top to, say, take beetles. And when they take beetles, you've got to work out where the concentrations of beetles are, which is all reliant on lake currents. Most people don't even realise that lakes have currents, but they do. So, like I say, anybody can go down and have a great day on their first day, but to understand exactly the full dynamic of a lake or river, you have to spend a lot of time on the water and you have to read a lot. You have to listen to people that can do it better than you.
So you're always not only guiding and teaching, but learning.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, we just came back from Alaska and learned a whole heap of techniques that I'll apply in Tasmania straight away.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Tell me what you learned, because that's salmon up there, isn't it?
There's salmon and trout up there, but the reason I went up was simply because the sockeye salmon, which migrate in prodigious numbers and have a really high fat content, they actually
drive. Which is what the bears love.
They actually drive the entire coastal ecosystem. And the sockeye fishery is in dire straits like our barrier reef. And when I was a small child, preschool, maybe 5 years old, I remember looking at an encyclopedia, seeing a bear atop a waterfall with a salmon sideways across its mouth,
and
just enchanted by it. And then in 1980, listening to ABC News, and they talked about Katmai National Park and Brooks Falls being, or Katmai, which was a national monument, being turned into a national park, and they mentioned Brooks Falls, and they had images of Brooks Falls. That was the photo in the encyclopedia. I wanted to go there.
So have you been?
And so, yeah, I've just come back from there. And
how
it was brilliant.
It was it
everything
just like the
I expected it to be. Oh, yeah. Like, you know, 20 bears underneath the waterfall and above it, and just hundreds of salmon jumping up over the falls and bears grabbing them in midair. And
Greg, where were you in relation to the bears?
Well, in Brooks Falls, even though it's remote, there's no roads there. You have to fly to a small town and then take either a dinghy or another small plane to the river mouth and then walk up to the falls.
Right.
It's really popular. It's one of the most spectacular wildlife events in the world. So you're actually on a platform and you...
With a fence?
No, you're just an elevated platform,
okay.
So that's fine. But look, afterwards, you do this thing where there's two platforms. One is a free-for-all. You jostle around. Everyone's very nice. Doesn't matter. You're going to see lots of bears anyway. If you get very close, you register. You might have to wait an hour or even 2 hours. Then you get a whole hour where you don't have to jostle. And that's fantastic. But afterwards, we want to go fishing, and you're allowed to fish above the falls, not right where the bears are. But
yeah, that's a good call, I reckon.
Yeah. But to get there, you've got to walk through dense head-high grass on bear trails. Scariest thing I've ever done.
Which made the actual fish you may have caught all the more sweet.
Yeah, and it was hard. Like, you could actually catch the sockeye salmon once they got above the falls, but you think, gee, after all the tribulations they've been through, they have to survive a commercial fishery in the bay, have to survive a recreational fishery in the river, have to survive the bears and the bald eagles and everything else. Didn't have the heart. We caught rainbow trout instead.
And then do you keep them or do you put them back in?
No, let everything go, basically. Right. But the sockeye salmon fishery for most people is a meat fishery.
So, Greg, what techniques for your own fly fishing and fishing in general did you bring back from Alaska for Tasmania?
Okay, so in Alaska, the trout fishery works like this. The salmon lay eggs, and the eggs have to grow to the fish have to grow after they've hatched to a small size before they can go to sea. And those fish are called smolts. The smolts are migrating downstream at the same time that the salmon are going upstream. And the trout feed on the smolts, and they just blast into them everywhere. There's fish all over the shop. But then also the spawning salmon lay eggs, the trout feed on the eggs, and then the spawning salmon die and flake away, and the trout feed on the flesh.
Okay.
So they're the things that you're doing.
The cycle of life all on
Definitely.
One river.
Yeah.
So when it comes to your own way of approaching the natural environment. Let me ask you, this is a bit devil's advocate, okay?
Yep.
Bear with me. Trout were introduced as an introduced species about 150 years ago into Tasmania.
Yep.
You argue that fly fishers are some of the best conservationists for Tasmanian wilderness you will ever see because they're out in it and they care about what they stand in and how they view the world.
Yep.
How do you reconcile the dichotomy between an introduced species forming your main reason for being out in the wilderness?
Okay. Well, first of all, I should say to your listeners, this is a long and emotional argument, the best way to do it is to read watercolour, because I've tried to, I've tried to do it very subtly and beautifully in watercolour. But for me personally, what matters is wild, and wild matters much more than anything else. And it, with climate change, and you see climate change everywhere, including in our valley, and there's some...
What have you noticed then?
Yeah, so in our valley, there's a story that I quite like about a bushfire up our little creek and what that does to the community. And disasters like that can either bring communities together or split them apart. Also what it does to the creek itself, because all the burnt animals that have somehow managed to survive, they end up down at the creek to drink, and a lot of them die there. And so the river ends up full, like absolutely chock-a-block full of
carcasses,
dead and dying marsupials. You know, what does that do to the fishery? But then straight after that, we have massive floods, and the floods are the biggest on record. All this is predicted by the climate modellers. And the problem when you have this type of weather event is that a flood following an unprecedented flood following an unprecedented drought means that the flood tends to negate the memory of the drought. And so,
what, in our minds,
in our minds. So, in places like Australia, because we have this, you know, flood, drought thing, people don't really get the impact of climate change in the way that they would, say, in Alaska, where it is just every year is warmer and drier than the previous one.
And there's less snow.
And you go to Peru, and a lot of the villages I went to in Peru are no longer there because the glaciers that used to provide the water have just gone. Or you go to the boreal forests and they're all dead because the spruce beetles have eaten them. Or, you know, it's just everywhere in your face. So it's much harder as an educator, I guess, to get people to feel the impact of climate change. But because when you're trout fishing, you're so intimately involved with the land that you can't help but see this. So one of the things I want to do for conservation is to get as many people out there. Fly fishing is not passive. You have to interact with nature and you have to be a good observer. And by doing that, you can't help but become intimate and care about the landscape. And the other thing I'd say about climate change is it is so radical all over the world that the species that lived there 200 years ago often can't live there anymore. We're going to have to put up with animals that weren't native to areas all over the globe suddenly being allowed to be there. Otherwise, we'll be living in deserts.
My guest is Greg French. He's a master fly fisher, a scientist, a storyteller. His latest book is called Watercolour. Tell people about that bloke you met, the Irishman.
Ah, yes. So the title of the book comes from a fellow I met on the South Island of New Zealand. And on the west coast of New Zealand, rain comes thick and fast. The rivers are clear. Suddenly they're dirty. Usually they get dirty in the middle and it goes out towards the edges. Because they're so steep, an hour later they're clear again, low and clear again. And I was fishing on one of these streams when a flood came along and I looked up and there's a fellow in front. Looked like he's stuck in the middle of the river. And I called out to help him and say, don't cross, you'll be able to cross it in half an hour's time. But actually he was collecting water. And it turned out that he was an artist. And he feels that water is the very essence of an environment. And for the people that rely on that water, it's the essence, their souls are trapped in this water. So he paints all his paintings from water, collected from where he is.
And so the water is the pigment of the landscape and the people.
Yeah, and sometimes you mix them with pigments. Sometimes you'll collect natural botanicals from the local area and mix it with the water to make his own paints. Sometimes he'll use commercial powder paints. But he had a great story. In Ireland, all the water is either tea-coloured or inky black.
And well, you got a bit of tea-coloured in Tasmania, can I say, because of the tannin.
Yeah, but not like... Not quite like Ireland.
Not peat bog tannin.
Virtually everything is.
Yeah, right.
And in fact, clear waters are so rare in Ireland that anything that does run clear has got magical properties. And so he's talking about when sometimes he said, I'd just paint with the water and use no pigment at all. And I could understand how peat, you could do it with peat. But how about that clear water? And he said, well, he's painted pictures of those Roman arch bridges with that you see on a lot of those beautiful Irish streams. And he said, and he used local water, mixed it with pigments, painted a beautiful picture. And then he got spring-fed clear water and painted the salmon just with the clear water. And when the water dries, you can't see anything. And he did it with a few other paintings as well. And he said people would look at these pictures and say, I love these pictures. You know, I can almost see the salmon jumping through those arches, or I can almost feel the presence of the riverkeeper. And those things actually had been painted in, but they were just invisible to the naked eye. That, he said, is the power of water. And I love it.
Because, I love that too.
Yeah.
It's like terroir.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Greg, I could quite frankly talk to you for the rest of the day, but unfortunately time is upon us. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me on, Michael.
Greg French, master fly fisher, science storyteller. His latest book, Watercolour, it's a beautiful thing to read. It's got little individual stories and vignettes about life on the land with friends, looking at science, looking at conservation values, and of course, overriding all of that, his relationship with rivulets and rivers and trout. This is Life Matters.